gazelle glasses, shell-toe Adidas, and a giant boombox radio. When I saw his shell toes, I told my moms and pops I wanted a pair, but they bought me the Olympians instead. At school the next day, Shaw said, "Nigga, them shits got 5 stripes. Adidas only got 3. But Shaw was my nigga. He didn't make fun of my shoes, at least not to my face. One afternoon, on the walk home from school, a crew of brothers, the Charlestons, were beating everybody up who cut through the woods. As I walked out of the woods and onto their street, I saw one of the brothers hitting people with a wooden Louisville Slugger bat on their legs, arms, and backpacks. Pops had taught me how to snatch a bat or a stick from somebody if they were about to swing it at you, practicing with a broomstick in slow motion. Never duck or try to move out the way if somebody's about to swing a bat at you, Pops told me. Rush them, get in close, then use your arm to grab the arm that they're swinging the bat with and hyperextend their elbow. But it's not the same in a real-life situation. The kid was about to take a swing at me, so I rushed him. But he was too big and hit me in the mouth with the slugger. Yo, this nigga made my bottom teeth go through my bottom lip. I was leaking blood in a daze. The expression on my friends' faces as they walked home with me made me think my face had been destroyed. In my bathroom mirror, I saw a little vein hanging out the hole right under my bottom lip. Uncle Lenny came by, and when he saw my face, he took me to the hospital to get stitches. I still got this scar to this day. Uncle Lenny was always very elusive. He'd be missing in action for long periods of time and then suddenly show up at our house. Lenny wasn't my real uncle, but I was raised to call him Uncle Lenny. He always took care of me when he was around. My mother made me move back in with her after about a year because I was sleeping in the cold, damp basement in Lakeview and kept getting sick. Mom's move to Lefrak in 1985, the hood right between Jamaica and Queensbridge, was a major turning point in my life. I turned 11, and she was letting me hang outside until the streetlights came on. The apartment complex was co-ops, not projects, but with all the drug activity, it wasn't much of a difference. Crack had come out a few years earlier, and almost every kid my age was selling it for older dudes. My first week in Lefrak, I was walking to the store, and who was sitting on a short wall by the parking lot but my friend Shamik, who lived around the corner from me in Lakeview. Shy and his family had just moved to Lefrak. What a fucking coincidence. Shy was obviously doing his thing, slinging drugs. You can usually tell if somebody was slinging drugs by looking at their jewelry and clothes. Shamik had all the new sneakers before they even came out. Fresh jeans and snorkel coats. I enrolled in Halsey Junior High School, right across the Long Island Expressway from Lefrak. On the first day of school, I saw kids with big rope chains, rings, and all the latest fashions. Lefrak was a cash cow for drug dealers. Everybody sold drugs. It made me stop caring about school and start caring about how I looked. Jewelry, clothes, sneakers, Nike Air Maxes, Louis Vuitton, triple fat goose bubble jackets. When the school bell rang at 3 p.m., everyone from Lefrak walked home together. Within the first 2 weeks, I got into it with this Indian kid who thought he was tough because he was taller than me. Everybody called me Pee-wee because I was so small. I don't recall exactly how the fight started, but I know for sure how that shit finished. A bunch of people from my block whipped the cowboy shit out that kid. After that day, we beat people up on our way home just for fun. This African kid named Mabunda didn't like me and wanted to fight. I was shook. In the crib on the couch, I'd be daydreaming of ways to sneak attack this motherfucker. One of my ideas was to walk up to him. "Hey man, I don't want no beef with you, man," I'd say, reaching my hand out to shake his. While I had his hand, I tried to break his nose or something. I practiced my punches beating up my mom's flowery, forest green couch pillows. I had another idea of carrying a D battery in my pocket to make my fist more solid. Bunda and I never got around to fighting each other and became real cool a year later. The first year of school was wild, and it only got wilder. Every building in Left Rack was named after a foreign country. I lived on the fifth floor of Peru. I made friends with two Puerto Rican brothers, Eric and Booby, on the other end of the hallway. The Peru building's lobby was attached to Columbia, where a dude named E and his brother Pop and my boys Justice and Zion lived. We all went to school together. I was coolest with Booby. I used to be across the hall in their crib every day. We ate dinner together and stayed up all night watching TV. I tried learning some Spanish from them, but I only picked up on the curse words. Booby was a DJ and had all the new rap albums. We wrote down entire songs to learn every lyric word for word. The Jungle Brothers, Jimbrowski, was our jam. They shouted out, "Jimbrowski in Left Rack." It made us proud to be from Left Rack. 1986 was the year of Mike Tyson. I saw my first Tyson fight at Booby's crib. It lasted about 30 seconds. After the fight, Booby and I went outside. Rakim, Biz Markie, Slick Rick, the Jungle Brothers, and Big Daddy Kane blasted from the boom boxes, and everybody was drinking and smoking. It was almost dark, so my time was limited. We drank our first tall cans of malt liquor, Schlitz, with the blue bull on the label, because the curiosity was killing us. My brother Greg gave me some sips in his beer when I was 5 or 6. Even let me take a pull of his weed. One toke, I was choking. After we tried a few swigs from the tall cans, I didn't drink again for a long time, because it was nasty. By the time I turned 11 and was living in Left Rack, my attitude about dance classes changed. I can't do that shit no more. But I was still there every Saturday because that was my family's business and because that was our hangout spot. I got my first piece of pussy in that place when I was 11. One Saturday evening, my Spanish homie Sean from Roosevelt, Long Island, took a girl to the basement and told her if she wanted to have sex with him, then she would have to let me hit it first. "Go ahead, have sex with him," he told the girl, nodding toward me. She agreed. I kept my boxers on. Afterward, I went upstairs to wash up in the bathroom, and there was blood all over my boxers. I looked down like, "Yo, what the fuck is this?" She had her period. Disgusting. I must have washed my pole like 30 to 40 times in a row. It was traumatic, and that was my first time having sex. My mom took dance classes at my grandmother's school in Jamaica ever since she was a little girl, and was still doing it faithfully every weekend. My grandmother had a group of female friends who helped her run the dance studio, including one of her best friends, Miss Barbara Brooks. Her grandson was Stobo, and he was still there every Saturday just like me. No longer confined to classes, we ran wild in the school and on Jamaica Avenue along with Stobo's real cousin Craig. Grandmom's other best friend, Joyce Gresham, had a grandson, John Michael. We called him JM. He was only 6, but he always wanted to hang out with Stobo and me. It seemed like every girl in Queens went to my grandmother's dance school. A lady named Miss Beverly Edge had 3 daughters, Donna, Wendy, and Kerry. The youngest, Kerry, who tried to set me up with Chutney Ross, was around 7 years older than us and taught Stobo and me all the secrets about what girls wanted and liked. Sitting on the floor in the dance studio one afternoon, Kerry was stretching while schooling Stoboing me about what women want. "Chaka, you always quiet and laid back," Kerry told me. "That's good, 'cause girls don't like guys that act foolish like little boys." Kerry tried to play matchmaker, hooking Stoboing me up with the pretty girls. We used to stare at the older girls in their tight dance uniforms, and Lord, there were some real thick bodies. Stoboing and I had a crew called the Jungle Brothers, named after the rap group. The crew consisted of me, Stobo, our friend Roger, who became a professional dancer, and my homie Sean. The sole purpose of our crew was to run trains on the girls in the dance school. I'd find a girl, take her into an empty room at the school, trying to convince her that if she wanted me, then she had to show my brothers love too. Some girls went for it, some didn't. At least 8 of the girls who went for it were snitched on by other girls. When parents started pulling their daughters out of the school, we got in trouble. But we kept right on doing our thing on the low. Roger was serious about making dance his career. He was West Indian and lived across the street from the USA Diner on Merrick Boulevard in Rosedale, Queens, a popular hangout spot for girls and hustlers. There was loads of action by Roger's house. His mother was strict, and he had a sister, Sandra, and an older brother known as Call Me Al. Roger explained that they called his brother Call Me Al because when they first moved to Rosedale, the dudes in his neighborhood tried to test his heart. When they asked his name, Roger's brother replied, "Just call me Al." A fight broke out and his brother whipped everybody's asses. From that point on, they gave him respect and their name, Call Me Al, stuck. Kool Rock Ski from the 80s rap group, the Fat Boys, lived down the block by Rosedale Bowling Alley. His bandmate, Buffy, aka the Human Beatbox, always drove up and down Merrick Boulevard in different Mercedes-Benz 190s with two-tone colors and curtains on the windows. Kool Rock's brother, Blaze, who I was real cool with, often hung out at Roger's crib. There was endless mischief to get into at Roger's crib. Green Acres Mall and Sunrise Multiplex were in walking distance. The Ninth Posse, a well-known street gang in that part of Queens, threw a lot of parties. Kerry dated one of the gang members, so she invited us. There were also a lot of reggae music parties because that side of Queens had a huge West Indian population. Roger, Stobo, Sean, Stobo's cousin Craig, and I bought 40 ounces of beer from Poppin' Kim's convenience store on Merrick Boulevard. Ice cold with the frost still on them. And hit all the parties. Beer was still nasty to me, but we drank it on those party nights. Late one night, Craig came up with a plan to break into a school a few blocks away in Rosedale. Craig had just came home from jail the year before and was already looking for trouble. He was 7 years older than us, around 18, and was the ringleader of all our early rebellion. We climbed up the side of the school and through an open window. We stole phones, copy machines, and other electronics. Craig sold it all for petty cash. Craig always had some type of scheme. He took Stobo and me on missions all over Queens, daring us to cross the Long Island Railroad tracks by Linden and Farmers Boulevard and to run across the Belt Parkway for thrills. After Craig turned us out with all this crazy shit he had us doing, we started doing a lot of wild pranks on our own. One summer morning, around 2 a.m., Roger and I saw a McDonald's 16-wheeler delivery truck pulled up in the McDonald's parking lot across from the USA Diner. From Roger's backyard, we saw that the back of the truck was open. So we ran over and took what we could. Crates of eggs, boxes of hash browns, burgers, buns, cheese, biscuits, pancakes, syrup, ketchup. Roger's refrigerator and freezer was filled with food. I don't remember what he told his moms, but the next morning, she cooked us a big breakfast. Stover and I were chilling at my grandmother's house in Hempstead one day when grandmas told us the TV star Emmanuel Lewis, a.k.a. Webster, and his brother were coming over. A girl from the dance school had started dating Webster's brother. Even though Webster was a dwarf or a midget, his brother wasn't. I called Carrie down the block to tell him the news. "Yo, Webster's coming to my house," I said. "Come over if you want to meet him." A few hours later, Webster, Carrie, Stobo, and I were in the living room when Webster started showing us his breakdance move. Backspins, windmills, even headspins. Oh, shit. Webster can breakdance. He's good, too. I remember seeing pictures of him and Michael Jackson together with Mike holding him up, carrying him like a baby. That didn't look too right to me. "Yo, what's up with you and Michael Jackson?" I asked Webster straight up. "What do y'all talk about when y'all together?" Webster got quiet and changed the subject. So I asked again, "Is Michael gay? What's up with him for real?" Webster acted as if he didn't hear my questions and walked into the room where my grandmoms was talking to his brother. I knew that Webster later denied it, but Carrie Stobo and I laughed about it for a long time, saying that Michael was a fruit cup and Webster was his little boy toy. I wanted my 12th birthday to be an event. Since Craig had just came home from doing a bid, grandmoms had given him a job cleaning and locking up the studio at night, so his parole officer would get off his back. I told Craig to get some weed and I'd buy the 40s. We were all going to get high for the first time late that night after everybody left. Stobo, Craig, Roger, Sean, and a tap dancer named Derek. Craig and Derek were the oldest. They'd both been high and drunk before, but it was the first time for the rest of us. We got so high and pissy drunk in my grandmother's office, Stobo stumbled out the building crying and screaming, "I'm blind! I can't see!" We walked from Jamaica Avenue up Merrick Boulevard all the way to Rosedale and crashed at Roger's crib. Stobo threw up in the toilet and passed out with his pants around his ankles on the bathroom floor. He had us all cracking up. That night was a pivotal point. I was about to become a teenager, and I thought I was becoming a man. I guess all the criminal, juvenile, delinquent mischief I was getting into was my way of having fun. Since sickle cell didn't allow me to do sports and stuff the other kids were into, I'm becoming a man, I thought. I have to make my own decisions, take control of my destiny. At 12, I started seriously getting into rap music. Rap exhibited the aggressiveness that had been in my heart and mind all my life. The first albums I bought were LL Cool J's Radio and Run DMC's self-titled debut, Sucker MCs. I repeated the verses to my moms, acting as if I wrote them. Rap music made me feel good for a change. One day after school, Booby came over and spit a verse for me. "Whose verse is that?" I asked. He looked at me like I was crazy.
"You don't know about the symphony?"
We walked to Booby's crib and he played the record for me. The song was from Marley Marl's In Control Volume 1 album. The verse Booby spit was Kool G Rap. "You can't replace me, ice me or ace me, base me, face me, slice me, erase me, bite me or taste me. I show you that I got force. My rap burns your mouth like hot sauce." After I heard that, there was no turning back. I was going to be a rap star. September came around again, and it was time for back to school shopping. And my moms couldn't afford the black construction Tims that I wanted. She put a pair of discount $19 motorcycle boots that looked like they were from Mad Max on layaway. I hated them. I wanted what was popular in the hood, so I decided to try my hand at crack. The biggest dealers in Left Rack went to my school. Two of them, my man Steve and my other man Jason, both of them wore jewelry, suede jackets in every color, and different sneakers every day. They had to be making $10,000 a week, no lie. Those kids had other kids our age moving G-packs for them. A G-pack was $1,000 worth of crack. There was an older dude in his mid-20s, B, who everyone worked for. After the first day of the new school year, I went to Jason's crib, where they cooked and bagged up the stuff. I told Steve and Jason that I wanted to get down. They gave me a test pack, about $100 worth of crack in $10 vials. I walked around the hood, sold it, and brought them the money. This is easy, I thought. Jason gave me one more test pack. I walked around and made 3 sales in the multi-level parking lot where people sold because it was shielded from the outside view. 2 white plainclothes cops walked toward me. I tried to walk away. Hey, kid, come here. Stop. They ran up and found a crack in my pocket.
What the hell is this little kid doing selling crack?
One undercover asked the other, then turned to me.
Why is somebody your age selling drugs?
I was 12, but I looked 8. They took the vials and sent me on my way. Still shook, I hopped the fence and took the shortcut home. The next day, when I told Jason what happened, he didn't believe me. He wanted his money, but I ain't have it to give. The following morning, Jason was waiting for me outside of school. He wanted to fight.
All right, cool, I said. We can fight.
While I was taking off my jean jacket and backpack, he snuffed me, knocking me down to the ground. He kicked me in my stomach and groin. All I could do was ball up into the fetal position until some girls from my building pulled Jason up off me. People watching the fight said Jason didn't score no points by not letting me take my backpack off. He didn't leave no bruises on my body, just my ego. Shamik, my boy from Long Island, who had also moved to Left Rack, and his homeboys asked if I wanted to get Jason back. But I let it go and stopped selling drugs for a while. I bought a switchblade and a BB gun and brought them to school every day. A gang called Boom Bash from Jamaica would beat people up, like 50 of them, waiting after school. A couple of the gang members, Bam Bam and K-Love, used to sit at my lunch table. I got cool with them, so I ain't had to worry about getting jumped. But I kept weapons on me just in case. You never know. One day, I left my mini black elephant skin JanSport backpack in the class by mistake, and the teacher brought it into the principal's office.
Albert Johnson?
I was called to his office over the loudspeaker.
Albert Johnson, please report to the principal's office immediately.
When I got there, he pulled the switchblade and the BB gun from my bag. I'm supposed to call the cops and have you arrested and expelled, the principal said. But I'm going to give you a break this time. He called my moms instead to tell her I was suspended for 2 weeks. Moms had to leave work to get me and yell the whole walk home. I was on punishment for a month. I had to be home by 4 p.m. instead of when the streetlights came on. Lying in my bed with my window halfway open, I could hear the whistle from the beginning of Rakim's My Melody blasting from a boombox. Laughter and loud chatter from everybody on the block chilling on the benches in the spring air. I was fiending to be back outside. After I got off punishment, I started spending weekends at my grandmother's house again. My grandmother had a VHS camcorder and tripod to record her classes and concerts. Carrie and I made a video to Slick Rick's Teenage Love. from his new album, Adventures of Slick Rick, in my grandmother's living room, along with at least 10 other videos. Carrie and I watched them just to make fun of ourselves. One night I passed out on a folded-out cushion seat in Carrie's basement bedroom. In the morning, I woke up soaking wet. I pissed this nigga's cushion seat. Foul. Carrie gave me dry clothes and a towel to clean up. I was too damn old to be pissing in the bed. The night after that embarrassing episode, Carrie stayed at my grandmother's crib along with Stobo. Grandmoms had just bought an Isuzu Impulse. She bragged about the car because it talked when you left the door open. Don't wear your seatbelt or left the lights on. And it was fast. 2 a.m. rolled around, and I stole the keys from my grandmother's nightstand while she was sleeping. Carrie, Stobo, and I snuck outside and got in the car.
The left door is ajar.
Goddamn talking car almost got us busted. We quietly shut the doors, started the engine, and we were gone. I'd never driven before, except for when Pops would sit me on his lap and let me stare when I was 6 or 7. Hempstead was like a ghost town at night. No police. After an hour circling the block and practicing parking, we snuck back inside. There's nothing like the thrill of stealing your grandmother's car for a late-night joyride. Stobo and I borrowed the car until we had driving down pat. We never got caught. Back in Left Rack, I finally got off suspension. I went back to school, back to the drama. After school one day, the Boom Bash crew was outside deep. My boys Bam Bam and K-Love told me some white boy had called a girl a nigger. When the white boy came out of the school, he had no idea what was waiting for him. 50 black gang members alongside the girl. Ouch. This is gonna hurt, I thought. The girl screamed and spit a lungi in his face. One by one, all 50 gang members spit on the white kid. When they were done, the white boy went home with his entire body covered in yellow slime. They could have beaten the life out of him, but decided to humiliate him instead. We walked back to the hood laughing our heads off. That weekend, Stobo stayed at my crib in Left Rack. We saw a large shadow drop past my fifth-floor bedroom window and heard a loud thump. A man jumped or had been thrown off the 16-story Peru building and landed on the park bench, cracking it in half, blood pouring from his face. Stobo and I ran outside. "Oh, wow," we both exclaimed, staring at his splattered brains. "Cool." We passed by the man's dead body, gazing in amazement, before the cops came and covered him up. We walked to the store on 57th Avenue, the drug strip in Left Rack. We went straight to the toy aisle and filled our pockets with bendable WWF wrestling figures. Suddenly, I felt a hand on my shoulder. Store security escorted Stobo and me into a back room and threatened to call the cops, but called our parents instead. "Here we go again." Stobo started crying. My mom's sister, Aunt Charlotte, who was watching us that day, came to get us. Aunt Charlotte's gangster, like a motherfucker. She was a bartender at a bar in Long Island City, Queens, back in the day. And one night, a man with a gun walked in, taking everybody up to the roof one by one, shooting them dead. Aunt Charlotte was last. The gunman led her up to the roof and shot her in the back of the head. She was the only one lucky enough to live. The bullet was lodged in the base of her head by her spine and still caused her severe migraines.
"Why did you have to pull this while I'm watching you?"